You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me for the first time Michael McKay. Capping a 20-year career in sales to Fortune 100 companies, Michael founded Iowa Capital Management in 1994. ICM is an investment firm with an international clientele where he currently serves as chief economist and president. Michael has been a lifelong student of how the world works, and specifically what incentives and motivations cause people to choose to cooperate in harmony with each other or not to do so. This led him to study the integration of economics, history, and law, and in particular, ethics, which Michael considers the foundation of law and economics. It is Michael's thesis that together these form our human ecology. For the past decade, Mr. McKay has studied and advocated reality economics. That's the term he coined for what academics call Austrian economics. Michael also founded and serves as host of RadioFreeMarket.com. Welcome, Michael, to Turning Hard Times into Good Times.
It's my great pleasure to be here, Jay.
Really good to have you here. Reality economics, why the use of the term reality economics as opposed to Austrian economics, if that's really what it is?
Well, the word economics is not known by most people at all anyway, and the short answer is reality is not optional. And basically, Austrian economics accurately describes how the world works. When I lecture about Austrian economics, the first thing I like to say is that economics is not a matter of opinion. It is a matter of just understanding how the world really works.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I absolutely believe you're right about that. But if the world really works and is described by reality economics or Austrian economics, why is it that we pay so little attention? Why is it that students are not brought up with reality economics in the universities?
Well, this is a broader philosophical question, but you know, I think that in the essence of it, I like to point out that there's two very different kinds of knowledge. One is functional knowledge, and the other is systemic knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And functional knowledge is, you know, we drink a glass of milk. We don't know how it creates protein in our muscle in our body. We just know that it does, and we learn that by tradition. And in the same way, people are not really concerned with the systemic functioning of how economy, the ecology of the economy really works, unless they're basically a philosopher. Not many people are.
Mm-hmm.
And so people don't reflect on that kind of thing. And in fact, if you look back over the last few hundred years, this has only become more and more of an issue as more and more people have become more affluent. I like to point out that the divisive terms of Keynesian economics, monetarism, and Austrian economics leave everyone who hears them in the general public basically cold.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what these different things mean. They don't know why they should pay attention to one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But and then they get into, when they start getting into it, you have to be able to follow more than one step of logic.
Mm-hmm.
And our culture really doesn't develop that.
Mm.
I mean, we actually, we're a soundbite culture.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really go that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the essence of Austrian economics, reality economics, can be summed up into three incontrovertible statements. These cannot be debated because they are essentially and 100% true. One is that humans act, the second is that humans choose, and the third is that humans both agree and disagree. Now, the first two of those statements, and you can see how they can't be debated, because
mm-hmm.
if you debate the humans act, you're acting. If you debate the humans choose, you're choosing. And if you debate the humans both agree and disagree, then you're agreeing or disagreeing. And so out of these three statements, and this was the brilliance of Ludwig von Mises, he started with humans act. And out of that, he basically, through deductive logic, helped people understand these essential aspects on the individual level. So you have to understand the individual level of humans as actors first, and then humans as interactors separate and second. So as humans act, there's this whole brilliant understanding that comes out of Austrian economics and the literature that's available there, and it's brilliantly outlined that why do we act? Well, as Mises said, we act because of a natural drive to remove boundaries, or as he put it, to remove feelings of uneasiness. Now, other people might phrase it in a positive way, a natural drive for greater happiness. But that is why we act. That is why we choose. And we're always in that kind of motion. But, and I won't go into detail here because this gets into a more lengthy conversation and it's very, very rich, but this brings up two additional questions. How do we choose and what we choose? And there is a very rich understanding that people can get educated on basically for free via Tom Woods at Liberty Classroom or Mises Academy or many other outlets that are available. But these are, I would say, the core sources for understanding this. And they basically boil down to the following. There is a understanding of time preference, marginal utility, determination of value, and subjective knowledge, and subjectively how we speculate on risk and uncertainty. Now, I can tell that those seem like very meaty statements, but they're really very, very simple. We choose based on whether we want something now or later. Most of the time it's now or sooner than later. We have a priority of how we assign different things. We determine the value of something by ourselves. It isn't based on how much you tell me I should pay for that pen or that necktie or that car. It's what I think it's worth. That's a subjective determination of value. And there's this other thing about subjectively understanding and assessing risk. This is a very individual activity that each of us do every single day. In other words, I'd like to point out, all of us are natural economists. People said to me, I don't understand economics. I said, that's silly. you understand economics every time you go to the sock drawer and you know it, tomorrow's laundry day.
Yeah.
Or you go to the grocery store or your refrigerator and you say, well, I have to get some eggs or milk. Or I'm in a hurry to get to the office or wherever because I have only so many minutes left. That is economics on the individual level. On the transactional level, then we get into the whole thing of property, money, rule of law, and all of those things.
Well, those are very important issues for sure. And with respect to property rights, we've talked about property rights recently on this show frequently. We've had Alana Mercer with us a few weeks back, and she talked about her book, Into the Cannibal's Pot. She talked about how actually people's safety have the safety of individuals living in South Africa, whether they're white or black, has deteriorated very significantly, and she laid that right to a demolition of property rights. Would you see a connection to that?
Absolutely, I see a one-to-one connection in that. I'd say all rights really are derived from property rights. I own myself, I own my time, I own my breath, I own my efforts, I own the fruits of my action, and comes with that, of course, the consequences of my actions. There's the personal responsibility aspect of that whole thing. And interference with property rights is obviously the biggest problem that we've got. And I'll jump ahead here, but the the real solution that we have to move toward is, as Hans Hermann Hoppe has so brilliantly stated, is to privatize everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could go more into that
particular
vein.
Well, certainly that would then would reduce the government's role in our lives, I would think. You know, it was interesting. One time I was talking to Ron Paul, and I related a personal experience. Our son, Scott, had a roommate at St. John's College in Annapolis who was somewhat left of Karl Marx when I first met him, but then he became one of Ron Paul's very ardent supporters. And I mentioned that to Ron, and he said, well, I think what happens is when you remove government, you basically bring people together because you allow them to interact according to their own needs more freely. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And one of the things I like to point out is that we need rules, we need laws, we don't necessarily need government to create, arbitrate, or enforce them. And I did a show on Radio Free Market a couple of years ago with Tom DiLorenzo, and it was called Stateless But Not Lawless. And it's still available for anyone that would like to Google it for free download. And that particular show focused on the Old West, which was not wild, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
There were rules, laws that were set up by wagon trains, mining camps, cattlemen associations, and so on and so forth. And in fact, the wildness of the Old West really arrived when the government arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually a very, very telling story. In fact, we did the show based on an essay that Tom had written that's published at the Independent Institute, and people can still find that there, and I recommend that essay. That, in my opinion, is probably one of the most important shows that we ever did at Radio Free Market.
Radio Free Market, is that radiofreemarket.com?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and people, and you're on there on a regular basis?
Well, we actually are changing the format of the show right now. We're making it more, we're changing it. I have had to focus my attention on other things lately, but I've assembled a number of excellent people that are contributing to Radio Free Market. We are looking for other good contributors for Radio Free Market so that we can present these principles of peace, prosperity, and freedom to people.
Mm-hmm. You, in your bio, you talk about, the bio that I just read, we talked about your belief that ethics are at the core of cooperation, if I understood that right. Is that your view?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I'm fond of saying that 90% of the world's problems could be solved by good manners.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if we look at the problems that we see around the world, there's this there's a duality in our thinking where we think we have to have good manners at the dinner table and you know, basically here and on the local level, but there's this schizophrenia in our psychology where we don't see it as stealing when people vote to take money out of other people's pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see it that way. We there's this mass cognitive dissonance, and it's a very large shift in consciousness that I see that is required in order for us to really make a big move. But I'm very optimistic about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to point out to people that 300 years ago, people could not envision a world that was not in some way centrally controlled by religion, where church and state were absolutely fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here in America, that is completely not the case anymore. It's not in our psychology. We assume that it is appropriate that church and state should be separate. So I ask people to do this little mind game. What would the world look like if we had a separation of money and state, banking and state, education and state, et cetera, et cetera? And we see this in that whole trend that is typified by that statement by Dr. Hoppe of privatizing everything.
Mm-hmm.
I was told recently that in the state of Indiana, all the road grading is actually done by private firms. Mm-hmm. Well, that's very cool, because what is happening there is that there's a psychological shift of throughout that particular state of that particular function, which is in my local area here in Iowa, is done by government, is done by private firms. Now, I don't know the results of that particular thing, but I do see a growing trend toward privatization. And, you know, the punchline is that it's going to continue for one basic reason. Governments are basically bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to unload a lot of this, these functions that they are doing. They have to go to private privatization. And I think that is the trend that I would that I'm very, very happy to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't privatization a lot of times, though, just mean that you have corporations that are in bed with government and acting together rather than in a free market?
Well, that's not privatization in the real sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people don't understand. They mix up capitalism and business. And I noticed that you like to use that word, crapitalism.
Yeah, well, it's,
capitalism.
We give the credit to Gene Epstein of Barron's, who's been on this show and figures to be on this show on a regular basis, and he says it's his definition of crony capitalism. He just simply calls it crapitalism.
Well, if people understood that real capitalism is that is the businesses that really do not get any advantage whatsoever from government. In other words, they don't get a license or subsidy or tariff or cartelization of any kind of protection that gives them an advantage over other people. And unfortunately, if you look at various different businesses today, whether they're interior decorators or barbers or any just about, well, a very large number of industries have decided, you know what, cartelization is good. We're going to go that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So funeral directors do that. And that's one of the reasons I'm a big supporter of the Institute of Justice in Washington, IJ.org, for people
mm-hmm.
who have never heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
And because they protect people's right to actually have a living. They, you know, sign makers in various cities in Minnesota, coffin makers, some monks down in Louisiana that make coffins that didn't want to get a funeral director's license, and you just want to make coffins because that's what they do,
mm-hmm.
or women that come from Africa that understand how to do this particular kind of weaving of the hair have been prohibited by these cartels to just engage in their day-to-day activity, their day-to-day economic activity, and told, no, I'm sorry, you have to go back to school and become a cosmetologist, when they don't even teach how to, whatever that's called, that kind of weaving at cosmetology schools.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't even required. So I think that what we're going to see is that people are starting to recognize that one of the primary aspects of government is how it prohibits a market to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Yuri Maltsev likes to point out that this is really how Nazi Germany differed in its socialism from Soviet Russia.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet Russia, they just declared that there are no property rights. Nobody really has any property rights.
Mm-hmm.
And the state owns everything. But in Germany, they were more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, you ostensibly have your property rights, but we're going to restrict you and we're going to regulate you
mm-hmm.
to the point to where you really can't do with your property as you really would like to do.
Right.
And that includes even engage in different economic activities. That kind of Nazi Germany style socialism is what we have here
mm-hmm.
in the United States, and the toxic aspect of that is that it grows under our feet and people don't really understand
mm-hmm.
how it is choking out the free market.
Mm-hmm.
We actually here in Iowa, people can see greater prosperity. They can see we have air conditioning, we have, you know, internet, we have, you know, more choices in many ways than we ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
But one place that we can see that our choices are shrinking dramatically is in what kind of work we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in my favorite economic or investment book of all time is Harry Brown's Fail-Safe Investing.
Mm-hmm.
And for your readers who have never, or listeners who have never read it, I highly recommend it. And one of the key points that Harry points out there is that your number one asset is your job,
mm-hmm.
your productivity, your business. Well, if you can't engage in a job, then how can you develop that particular asset? That is the foundation of how you as an individual or I as an individual are going to actually create wealth for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, we see this extended to the workplace by minimum wage laws, which make it very unattractive for a business to hire people because they have to hire them at a particular minimum wage, which may be more than they're worth. And the net result of that is this massive unemployment that affects young people.
Mm-hmm.
So I see the world becoming very clear as to where we don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, I think, is making the world more clear as to where we want to go to.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly, before we went on the air, you were talking about manners, ethics, and you noted that we certainly do observe them. Otherwise, we would have, you know, utter chaos everywhere. We can drive down the highways and things are fairly safe, and we can do, you know, we do respect each other to a great extent. But if ethics is at the core of our well-being, then where does that come from? Where do good ethics come from, and how do we improve on them? Is it just simply a matter of less government? And if so, how do we get people to understand that to be the case? Because if anything, people are looking to government always for their betterment, not to themselves.
Right. There is a trend, and this trend is pervasive, to look to a government, a higher body, for everything,
mm-hmm.
as a solution to all things, as opposed to the family unit and so on. It may seem trite to say the family has to start this. I actually think, and I ponder this, how to write children's books,
mm-hmm.
that would teach children these ABCs, that money is a thing. Mm-hmm. Money is property. We need people to actually start teaching their children these kinds of basic rules and laws of how the world really works at a very, very early age. The other thing that we have to understand is how we are actually controlled. And I know this smacks of conspiracy, but I don't really see conspiracy theories. I see spontaneous order of predators.
Mm-hmm.
I see how various different elements of society interface with one another in a spontaneous order of mutual advantage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the methods that they use that I see that are, of course, central to this entire process are definitions, stories, money, coercive power, and, of course, the big one of all, fear.
Mm-hmm.
And money and coercive power, they point to property control.
Mm-hmm.
Because to the degree that central control, coercive power, can regulate, what is the worst toxins, taxation or regulation? My particular thesis is that it's regulation.
Mm-hmm.
That you can have higher taxation and virtually and very little regulation, and you will see a greater prosperity come about,
mm-hmm.
because new jobs can get created, new products can get created, new entrants can enter into the dynamic workforce.
Mm-hmm.
But those that cooperate with defining, changing definitions of things, and changing the stories, again, going back to Tom DiLorenzo, a book that everyone should read is The Real Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a completely paradigm-shifting book to understand that he is not Saint Lincoln. and this gentleman really, we can put at his feet many of the problems that we're facing today.
Mm-hmm.
And but definitions are very important. And so, I think from my own view is that this kind of shift in consciousness and understanding is a multi-generational effort.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that it is incumbent on each and every one of us to do as much as we possibly can do on the family level, on the community level, on the friend level, to try to educate as many people as we possibly can touch and influence to at least understand these basic principles.
Mm-hmm.
That was the motivation behind starting Radio Free Market 3 years ago. I wanted to just create a number of basic introductions to economics, how law and economics and history and ethics were all tied together. And one of the things that we are doing right now is we're restructuring the website because, you know, we poured in volunteer time, and it's been laborious because, you know, we have our families and our own jobs and so on to try to maintain. And so the content is excellent. On the other hand, I would like to improve it dramatically so that people can find the good content in there, because we have Tom Woods has got some great lectures in there, Yuri Maltsev, Lou Rockwell has been in there, Paul Prentice has some wonderful lectures on morality and economics, Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute, and many others. I mean, we've just been really blessed by a wonderful array of people who have contributed to that.
Well, there certainly are a list of libertarian free market thinkers that you just named there, that's for sure. Well, if property is at the heart of our morality, the respect for property rights, and I certainly do buy that, we have a confiscation of property through a very pernicious but not very well understood process of debasing our currencies, and it seems to me that there's this notion that somehow we can get something for nothing if we just look to government. And I had one of the pivotal people in my life was a Dr. Peyton Yoder at a small school called Heston College in Kansas where I went. 1967, Dr. Yoder made some remarks that really caused my career to sort of take a different path long term. And that was, he saw a correlation between the debasing of a currency and the work ethics and the morality of a nation. And I thought that was an interesting concept and sort of watched it take place with the Vietnam War and socialism coming more and more into the United States, this notion that you could have something for nothing. I guess people have to understand, first of all, they have to understand that money is property, as you say, and sort of understand how their property is being stolen or being taken away through government's gifts to other people, purchase of votes, I guess.
Well, there's many ways in which our property is being taken from us, and you say a beautiful word that describes that, perniciously. And it's not merely by taxation. It's not merely by regulation.
Mm-hmm.
It's by subsidies. It's by tariffs. It's by, and I would say probably the biggest of all, the ignorance of the public as to some of the very basic ways in which money works at its root. That's why I wrote this very small book. It's called Secrets About Money That Put You at Risk. It's available. There's a link on my website at radiofreemarket.com where you can actually get the book for free. You can buy it on Amazon as well, and that you're welcome to do so. Anybody that does, we pour the money right back into our efforts here. And it points out that there are four aspects about money that most people are not aware of. These are things that people should have learned in high school but never did. And they are fiat money, fractional reserve banking, legal tender laws, and inflation. And to understand those four basic aspects of money and how money works and how money works today, how it actually works in the system today, will provide people in probably a half an hour it takes to read this short book, at least a foundation of understanding these core concepts. I put a number of references in it, which are designed to actually get people to read the more important works, the better and deeper works on this, from Mises, Rothbard, and so on. And they're all in that book, and I would refer people to that.
You know, we're basically out of time for this segment, and I'm wondering if you could come back perhaps on the other end of this hour today. I'd like to ask you a couple more questions. We've talked so far sort of in philosophical terms and, you know, what has caused the problems that we have to an extent. But, you know, the world is what it is, and we would all like to make it better. We'd like to do what we can, our small part, to help things along for our children and our grandchildren. But it is what it is today, and so the question I'd like to ask you, if you can come back and discuss it, is what do we do from here? How do we protect ourselves from here? And you also had some very interesting ideas that I'm aware of concerning Basel III and how really economics, the reality of economics, real economics, starts to force its way, whether governments like it or not. And I'd like to sort of talk about what you see, a possibility of gold making its way back into the monetary system and some signs that that may actually be starting to take place. Could you come back on the other side of the hour to talk to us some more about
it? Sure, be happy to.
Wonderful. That's really great news. Well, folks, don't go away because we're going to be right back in just a minute or two.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.